Hey everybody, Stu Smith here again with another Two Through and After show that we do with special guests. And our special guest today is former pararescue, Air Force pararescueman, Matt Scollard. And you might be able to find him really popular over on Instagram. That's where I found him, Special Om Parader. We'll talk a little bit more about that journey, what got you into that. And but first of all, welcome. Thank you so much for coming on. I can't tell you how many people have asked me over the years, like, yeah, you got to interview a PJ. I'm like, okay, let's do it. So anyway, I'm a big fan of PJs. So let's get started. So who were you, Matt, you know, when you were a kid? You know, growing up, where'd you grow up? And, you know, what was your life up until like the decision you decided to join the military?
Yeah, for sure. Well, first things, I'm super excited to be here. Also a big fan of yours. <Thanks. laughs> was, I think I mentioned before, which I'll get to in a little bit, but definitely had your book there with Tony Alexander on the cover. let's see, who was I as a kid? Well, I didn't grow up like most of my military peers. My dad was a helicopter engineer for Sikorsky, and always took overseas assignments. So when I was three, we actually moved to Sigonella, Sicily. I was born in the United States, and I spent the remainder of my developing years until I was 17 overseas. So I started out in Sigonella. We were over there at NAS, it was at NAS 3, I believe it was called. Yeah. We were there for about 3 years. I remember early on, my dad, I don't know if there was a SEAL team there. There was definitely a few SEALs that float around. My dad was buddies with them, and they would come over. And I was 4 or 5 years old, at the kid at the pool, and bobbing and drown proofing. And they'd have me pick up weights at the bottom of the pool. And just remember always being in love with the water. It's where I learned how to snorkel and really kind of developed this like love of the ocean there. From there, we moved around Europe, Germany, Austria, and then
nice.
Korea, Australia, Bahrain, basically everywhere where there was the possibility for helicopters. And it wasn't always U.S. military. For example, we lived in Bahrain. My dad was the helicopter engineer for Sheikh Hamad, the Crown Prince's helicopter program. So as a kid, I had to sit outside the military bases and like look inside, but I was always mingling with like the local communities and stuff. So it was kind of this weird position to be in, to be like, well, I'm an American by passport, but I really don't have much knowledge of what that is. But I was your typical child of the 80s, influenced by Top Gun. And for the longest time, I was convinced that I wanted to be a fighter pilot.
Me too.
Yeah,
that's my story.
They get you, man.
That's good, man. It was badass.
And then it shifted when Charlie Sheen's movie came out. Then I wanted to be a SEAL. And then, but I grew up very influenced by the military. I had a lot of, both my parents were in the Navy. I had a lot of military. My grandfather was in the Navy, had a lot of military presence around me with my dad's profession. Everything kind of shifted when I was 7 years old. I learned how to windsurf. We were living in Australia at the time, and I learned how to windsurf. And at that point, my life basically became obsessed with, how can I just do this for the rest of my life? How can I surf, and how can I windsurf, and how can I just make sure that I'm forever always on a body of, or in a body of water somewhere, somehow. So, with that seed planted, I continued to move throughout the world, and I was just into skateboarding and surfing and being in the ocean when I could. And I swam. That was like the one thing, because I grew up in Australia. I lived in Australia for about 6 years, actually.
Dang.
Because I was there for so long, swimming is such a big sport of theirs. I became a pretty decent swimmer, but.
Competitively, you swam competitively while you're younger.
Yeah, I swam competitively at like the like local level. The athletics weren't really an option for me because I was an American. It was just this weird state. I was sort of like always trying to find my place in the world. Where, sure. You know, I went to, because we moved so frequently, I went to 18 schools in 12 years.
Good Lord. Yeah. Man, that is quite diverse.
Yeah.
So a diverse education. How many languages did you learn?
You know, enough languages to get myself in trouble in a lot of languages, but I became a master of accents. So that's the one thing that I can still have about me, because I learned how to speak with an Australian accent or, you know, or any accent, whatever. So that's my one specialty, but no other languages. Yeah. But what it did teach me was how to connect with people really easily.
Being
the new kid, and always wanted to make friends and to sort of find some commonality, I became pretty good at just making friends quickly. So that's, and finding comfort wherever I am. Like, if we don't speak the same language, I learned that humans all speak a universal language, especially when you're kids. And I learned how to speak that language pretty early on. So I guess that's the one foreign language I learned. So fast forward, I was in Australia, in Northeast Queensland, in Townsville, Australia, for my high school years. There was an SAS detachment that used to come out there, and I was exposed to those guys in high school. They were some of my dad's friends, and like, I learned how to Aussie rappel, you know, took me out like that. So I always had this like thought process that, you know, maybe I want to do something like that. Like, I'd given up the idea that I was going to be a SEAL just because I wasn't exposed to that anymore. You know, I was in high school and I was figuring the world out, and I didn't really have a path. It was like, okay, well, I just got to graduate high school in Australia and then hopefully somehow make it back to the United States where I can do who knows what. So I graduated high school in 1998, and I left Australia and I moved back to the United States, and my parents were still overseas, and I was living with my grandmother in New Jersey. So grew up all over the world, like lived in, you know, Korea, the Middle East and Australia and all these different places. And I end up in New Jersey, and it was like, well, this is a bit of a culture shock for me. Really wasn't quite prepared for. So at that point I started to look for like a more definitive path with what to do with my life. I sort of ruled out the military just because I was like, well, I don't think that's for me. You know, I was angry and pubescent and in high school, or just graduated high school and was angry at the world. And I'm like, yeah, I'm not going to go be told what to do. did like the community college thing for like a year and just kind of bounced around, and it all changed one day. My parents had actually moved back to the United States, to Florida, to Jacksonville, and I had moved down to their house and was living there for about 3 months. And you know, I was sort of feeling the pressure. I think I had like just turned 18 at that point, and was starting to feel the pressure of like, well, I should, you know, probably do something and pick a path in life. And I was feeling it from my parents and sort of feeling it internally, like, you know what, I think I'm actually like, I have a lot of potential, and let me see what I want to do. So this is all pre 9/11. So
yeah,
this,
sure.
I'm like researching different military paths. And I'm like, yeah, you know, maybe I could go be a SEAL. Like, yeah, I could revisit that. You know, my eighth grade yearbook says that I want to go to Annapolis and I want to be a Navy SEAL.
There you go. Like, there's a path
for me, right? You may know a thing or two about it. And I was sort of just kind of buying myself time over the months. By this point, I had a really fun job. I was working for British Airways at the time, and I got to speak with my British accent that I learned, and was having fun just kind of messing around. And it all changed when the movie The Perfect Storm was released.
Oh, classic. And I was wondering if that made some PJs.
Oh man, well, it made me, that's for sure. I'm watching this movie. Besides, you know, George Clooney's rugged handsomeness and him as Knocky Knox little dynamic, the scene at the end of the movie, man, when they're out in those seas and I'm just like watching this ocean, I'm just mesmerized at like, oh my God, like, yes, like that is what I want to do. And the guy puts on his mask and he gets to the edge and he jumps out of the helicopter and he does his low and slow. At that point, it was like a high and slow. And he hits the water and he swims over and just all cool, calm, and collected, introduces himself. And he's just like, literally the calm in the middle of the storm. And I was like, that I need to do that job. And my parents, you know, they didn't know anybody. Like, oh yeah, he must be a Coast Guard rescue swimmer. I was like, okay. Very next day, I'm like running over to the Coast Guard recruiter. Like, I need to do that job. I want that job that that guy is doing. And this recruiter, man, I don't remember this guy's name, but I have a lot of respect for him because he wasn't like, oh, he didn't sit back in his chair and like, yep, that was a Coast Guard. He's like, no, man. He's like, actually, I was an Air Force pararescue man. And he's like, most people don't really know that they exist. They don't know much of most people don't know that this career field exists. And he directs me over to the Air Force recruiter.
Nice.
And, yeah, I was like, right on. So then I was like, oh my, yeah. So then I run over to the Air Force recruiter the same day. And I was like, hey man, I saw this movie, The Perfect Storm. I want the guy, the pararescue man that jumped out of the plane. I want that job. Excuse me. And the first thing the guy says, he's like, yeah, well, nobody ever makes it. He's like, okay. And he gives me a brochure and sends me on my way. And I'm like, oh, okay. So go home. And now I have this brochure, which I'm holding. I still have this thing. This brochure is 20 years old at this point. I still have it. And it's like Iron Medical Man. And I remember I'm reading through it. And there's a guy inside. And he's like rappelling down a mountain. He's got a Stokes basket. And there's the ocean. And there's like he's shooting and free fall with his, you know, old MC5 parachute. And I was hooked. I was like, yeah, I get to do all this and be the guy that jumps out of the helicopter in the middle of the ocean. Like, I'll take 10, please. Yeah, sign me. So then I was trying to be somewhat prepared and, you know what I was getting into. And this is like, you know, the internet really wasn't a thing. You couldn't just get on a forum and read what everybody had done before you or anything like that. So I go to the Barnes & Noble bookstore and sure enough, there's this book right there, this little blue book, Air Force Special Operations.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So I bought it, man. And I bought that book and your book and Jack Brem's That Others May Live and was just reading and absorbing as much as I could and realized like, yeah, this is the path that I want to follow. This is the job that I want. So I credit The Perfect Storm with being the catalyst for change in my aimless direction of youth and like, okay, well, no, here's your path and here's what you're going
to
do.
Yeah. That's a good way to put it. Cause you know, obviously, you know, the perfect storm wasn't the reason you became a PJ, but it was the very first little thing that clicked something in your brain that says, that's what I want to do. You know? Yeah. It's I'm the same way. Yeah, I learned about the Navy, learned about the Academy, learned about, you know, being a pilot through Top Gun. And yeah, you know, luckily we had like several SEALs that were on the base, you know, that were instructors there. And I was like, what are these guys? You know, went to my first SEAL PT and just got crushed. And I was like, okay, this is what I want to do. I want to get better at this. You know, it's the same type of thing. So what were any problems that you had during this journey? Cause you know, coming from multiple countries and foreign national friends and all that, how was that joining the military? Did you have to have anything special occur? Well, I know this was pre 9/11 though, so it might not have been that bad.
Pre 9/11, but it was early. You know, this is January of or late 2000, and then early 2001. So my first experience when I enlisted was like, okay, made up my mind, I'm gonna go be a PJ, and I enlisted and was sent off to basic training. One of the first experiences, I think it was like the very next morning when you shuttle in and they have you up and they're like, we're gonna sing the national anthem, and I'm like, I don't know the national anthem. Like, what do you like? I can sing the Australian national anthem, but
that's funny.
So, have you seen the movie Nacho Libre when Jack Black, like he's like kind of like mouthing, and that was me, like kind of just like looking around, like smiling, like trying to make my mouth look like everyone else's, and like humming the tune that I think is the national anthem.
So, wow.
Yeah. So that was the first one. And there really wasn't too much. I had been around so many different people in my life that I was able to make friends and connect with people and find commonality. But one of the most defining moments was at basic training. So in your book, you had the PJ book, there was, you had Tony Alexander be one of the guest models instructors in the book. And I remember watching him demonstrate eight. I was reading the book, and he's doing eight count bodybuilders, and he's this little guy on a black and white piece of paper. And then he comes in when we're in basic training to give the pass test. And the guy's 6'4", just I mean, I'm not a little guy, but I'm looking at this guy oh man, this dude's the real deal, right? So he'd gone from the glossy pages of your book to now he's the real deal. But anyway, to answer your earlier question about some of the things that I had experienced, there really wasn't too much. And even by the time 9/11 had happened, I was so fired up and so ready to be. To be a part of the greater good that I didn't really think too much of it until later in life of how that affected me. But at that time I was 19, 20 when 9/11 happened. I was 20. And I was still forging my path ahead, getting ready to go save the world. It did come up in a few years later though, for sure.
Right. So how about this? The journey to become a PJ has become a lot more streamlined now with their prep course right after basic military training, and then they go into the selections and assessments and stuff. How was it back then? What was the journey, from going from Air Force basic into a PJ training pipeline? What was that like?
Yeah, for sure. And you're right. It has shifted dramatically, and even more so in the past few months. I'm not super read into the whole process. So I'm not going to speak to it. But back when I went through, it was you completed the basic military training, and then you attended the pararescue indoctrination course.
Okay.
And that was a 10-week. It was a selection course where it wasn't like BUDS. It wasn't the Q course. It's its own unique selection course where every day it's running, calisthenics, water confidence, distance swimming, and just the constant mental and physical stresses that go along with a selection course. For PJs, our stressor that they use in our selection course was the pool and the water confidence training. Similar to the way that BUDS uses the wet and sandy and just sort of the grind of,
right.
of exhaustion and Hell Week and such, our stressor, the primary stressor, was the pool, which for me was probably the easiest part of indoc. For me, I would take the pool over. I'm not a runner by any stretch of the imagination, and that was the area that I struggled the most with. To the point where we're running and I'm just man, I don't know that I could keep up with this, right? And then we get to the pool and I'd be like, whoo. Meanwhile, everyone else is quitting. And it was challenging. It was a challenging program. One that I think my indoc class started with 100 and something people, and I think of that 100, 10 made it to the end of indoc, and then of those 10, I think maybe 5 or 6 actually made it all the way through the rest of the pipeline.
Nice.
But the pipeline, so once you finish indoc, that 10-week program, then you go to the combat dive school, which there used to be the Special Forces Combat Dive Course down in Key West, and then the Air Force opened their own dive school in Panama City, Florida. It's a 5-week combat diver course that's open circuit into closed circuit.
Nice.
That's your first exposure once you leave indoc. You're you're actually learning a skill at that point.
Right.
You're not being selected. They're training you up to how to dive. And
it's not uncommon, the SEAL phases of BUDS. They just have it all in one location, where our first phase is the beat down, just calisthenics. You don't learn anything other than how to get kicked in the nuts and not.
Right.
But the next phase is, you're right. We have that dive phase that goes open circuit and the closed circuit, a lot of pool work.
Yes.
I would say that's pretty challenging, but yeah. So what would you say to the young person who wants to join the PJ program, as far as where would you recommend they focus their attention primarily?
So I've been asked that question a lot over the years, and my answer is always the same, and it's learn how to be comfortable being really uncomfortable. So however that looks to you, whatever brings you the most amount of discomfort, if it's rucking, if it's running, if it's being in the pool, spend more time finding comfort in the discomfort.
Yeah.
And that's something that we, especially as young people, young men, we want to focus on the things that we're good at, the things that make us feel good, right? Like, hey,
sure,
I'm a great runner. I can already run a 6:15 mile. I'm going to run even faster. But how are you when you get in the water? Can you pick up a buddy and carry him? So, and however that looks, if sleep deprivation is something that you know you struggle with, or whatever it is, it's have that accountability of yourself and that knowledge of yourself that you recognize when you are uncomfortable, and shore that up and become more confident and more at peace with that discomfort.
Yeah. I always tell people you got to work on your weakness.
Yeah.
It's all weaknesses. Cause no matter what your journey is prior to the military, we come into it with some weakness, whether you're a three sport athlete or you're a surf rat, skateboard guy, or whatever, you know, you're going to come into this world with a certain amount of strengths and a certain amount of weaknesses. And you're right. Getting comfortable with those weaknesses is critical.
Absolutely.
So do you think you're ready? When did you think, like during your assessment or maybe during your pipeline training, like, I got this, you know? When was that moment? Did you have a magic moment of like, hey, I think I could do this?
Yes, but it was always, I never allowed myself to truly feel that, just because it's such a long process. It takes 2 years to become a PJ.
Yeah.
There's so many obstacles, and every single day you are being tested at a level that up until that day you had never been tested in your life till. And it goes from everything of like, hey, pass this 5 mile run, to, hey, stick this IV in this mud pit in the middle of winter in the dark in Albuquerque. Like, these are all hey, jump out of this plane at 13,000 feet and land within 20 feet of this X at night and land within 10 seconds of the guy in front of you. And it's like, everything is just a progression, and you're always having to prove your skills and your assimilation of those skills.
Nice.
And I often wanted to be like, hey, you know what? I think I'm going to make it through this process, but I never truly was like, oh yeah, I got this, because I feel that the second I would have been like, oh, it's easy street from here on out, I maybe would have become complacent, and I would have either gotten injured or was unprepared for maybe the day that I was not ready for some challenge and I wouldn't rise to meet it. So every single day I approached it with the, like, this could be my last day of this program, so I better show up and give it 100%.
I like that. That's
yeah. Cool. And I think most of the people that I went through with shared a similar mindset, because there's so many skills that you have to become sound at, and so much information that you have to absorb and be able to apply, that at any given time, if you let your guard down, like, that could be, it could be fatal, or it could just be the end of your training.
That's a good point, because, you know, that learning curve is steep. You know, it is a steep learning curve, and they feed it to you with a fire hose, and you you have to absolutely got to hear it once, and then you got to go do it.
And then you got to be an expert. Yeah.
Yeah. And then you got to go do it. Yeah.
And you see what PJs do is like, oh, it's sexy. They get, you know, free fall and scuba and all this other stuff, but they don't see that the reality is those are just methods to get to work. When we get to work, it's advanced emergency medicine, dirt medicine. We're doing stuff that, like, we're administering blood in the back of an armored vehicle that we just cut our way into. And like, there's all these skills: confined space rescue, structural collapse, mountain rescue, all biomes on Earth. And it's so much information, and you constantly have to approach it that you don't know everything, but you have to do your best to learn. And you got to show up every day.
Yeah, it's such an impressive group. So what did you do, you know, once you're finished with your training? Let's talk a little bit about your special ops unit that you join. What was that like?
For sure. So at that point, you're a three-level PJ. You've spent 2 years becoming this pristine badass that you've sacrificed so much to become. And now you get to your unit and you realize like,
you're a new guy.
And then you start back at the bottom, right? You've spent 2 years to get entry into the most exclusive club on earth. And now you're back at the bottom again, because now you have to do your upgrade training. You have to learn how to be comfortable on aircraft, fixed wing, rotary. You have to become more precision jumper. You have to be a search diver and all these additional skills. So the training never stops. No. But what becomes asked of you is you now have to put these things into practice. So at the time, the early to mid 2000s to late 2000s, we're obviously fighting in two different combat zones between Iraq and Afghanistan, and the deployment rotation was swift. It was 5-6 month deployments, and going over there and holding everything from waiting for a pilot to get shot down behind enemy lines to, embedding with a SEAL team to be their CSAR, combat search and rescue, platform. You're staged for an astronaut rescue, like all sorts of different things. You always find yourself employed. One of the things that brought PJs more into the mainstream was sort of maybe 2006, 2007 in southern Afghanistan. The CENTAF commander at the time was like, hey, we got dudes, all from ISAF, they were just dying all over the battlefield. And you mean to tell me that I have these guys, these super ninja rescuing combat slaying medics that are just waiting for like something bad to happen? Why don't we send these guys to go rescue, at the point of injury? So at that point, the mission load went from maybe like one or two missions a week to like 8 or 9 missions a day. Like, doing like Vietnam style, like guys are out, conventional military units are out, and they hit an IED, get blown up, and now we're flying out, and we're getting out of the helicopter, cutting them out with the jaws of life, stabilizing them, treating them, packaging them up, flying them back to the Roll 3 hospital, getting them treated, replenishing the helicopter, getting back in and doing it all again all day long. And then at that point, every combat reporter in the United States and all over the world was like, well, I want to embed with these guys, and I want to block them.
Yeah.
And the ops tempo never slowed down, for most of the duration of my career. It didn't slow down. It was very, very frequent, and finding yourself in all sorts of unimaginable situations. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. The Air Force has depending on the situation, obviously the op tempo, you're here so many months, you're at home so many months. How was that ratio for you? and I know during, like, because you're a PJ, you're part of SOCOM.
Right.
So it's a little bit different, operational headshed there, but how was that, that ratio home?
Yeah, it's, looking back, I can see how on paper it was designed to offer a sustainable amount of dwell time. But you know how it is when you get back, it's like, oh, hey, you're up for your jump master course. So
right.
Take off for 5 weeks. Oh, hey, I got you set up for this team leader evaluation in Alaska. You got to go there. Oh, hey, the unit's participating in exercise in Chile. I need you to go to here. So it's like, yeah, you might have like 6 months on paper where you're at home reconstituting. But of that 6 months, you're gone for 4.5, 5 of it.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember, it was funny. I remember when my wife and I were dating, that a 2 to 3 week trip was just so easy.
Yeah.
it was just like, I'll be back in 2-3 weeks, son. I got,
not even a thing.
I'll see you next month. Easy day. Now, I go away for 2 days. I'm like, oh God, I can barely stand it. but yeah, you're right. The op tempo, when you come back and you got to train at other places, it changes a lot. Now, the cool thing about Navy Special Warfare, Air Force Special Warfare, is they're starting to create such a, a better training infrastructure that they can actually do a lot of those things locally and hire the people to come to you versus go to them, which
absolutely
saves a lot of the op tempo. Spends more money, but probably saves more op tempo.
Yeah, there's been a massive development of whole person, whole warrior development, where they really are putting a lot of focus on sustainability for the operators, rather than, oh man, we're going to run this guy dry
until
his body or his mind is destroyed. And then, you know, all right, thanks. Yeah. Now it's, you know, now it's like, hey, let's really invest in these people. And let's really work on sustaining their careers, their bodies, their minds. You know, guys are coming out injured, either, you know, psychologically or physically. And there's a really solid rehabilitation program that prepares them to get back in the fight. And it's not just on the operator, it's on the families. And yep. So I see a lot of these programs, and I'm really proud of them for focusing. Oh,
yeah. Absolutely. The human performance is way beyond strength and conditioning.
Oh my God.
You know, that's just like 10% of it.
Yeah.
You know, which is really incredible. So now let's take it from, all right, you've been in the Air Force for some time now, what, about 10 years?
12 and a half, yeah.
12 and a half. And you decide to make a change. Yes. What were some of those decisions and reasons for deciding to get out?
Well, I was of that era that did not necessarily have all the warrior whole person concept opportunities available to me. It was the ops tempo caught up with me. The some of the things that we were being asked to do. You know, you can only show up at somebody's worst day of their life so many hundreds of times, and it not impact you. And ultimately, it started to impact me. I recognized individually that I was definitely suffering some post-traumatic stress. From, you know, I credit a lot to a lot of the you know, the pediatric missions that we went on, you know, the children caught in the crossfire, and, you know, the innocence of them seeing the reality of combat and war day in and day out, and really not having a creative outlet, or any outlet for that matter, to be able to work through these feelings and these emotions. And the human body, the human mind and soul and spirit can only take so much trauma. You can only see so much and only be involved with so much before it starts to find a way out. And that's different for every human.
Sure.
For me, I started to recognize it. I started to have sort of nightmares. I started to, you know, drink a lot. And I had tried to penetrate this conversation with several people, and it never really was accepted. It was a weird time period, right? Like, guys are all dealing with their own traumas, their own psychological stress, and we didn't have the tools to overcome and move beyond them. And I recognized that it wasn't sustainable for me, and I needed to make a change in my life. And ended up choosing to separate at 12 and a half years. And then at that point, I made the decision to prioritize on and focus on my mental health and my wellness, and to recover and find some sustainability for my existence so that I could move on to the next phase of my life at that point.
Yeah. So have you always been involved with yoga?
No. Oh my God. No. I used to be 240 pounds, meat house, you know, deploying with the SEAL teams.
Hey, let me do this. I'm going to share my screen and show everybody what we're talking about here. So as you can see, this is your Instagram. Everybody, you got to go check out Special Om Parader. And this is him. He's all jacked now. Look at him. Right? And then, but yeah, here you go. Doing some axle squats.
Yeah, sleep, eat, and lift program there.
Yep. Yeah. And now look at you. Doing handstand splits and... Damn, crazy stuff. Were you in Japan?
I was. I was in Okinawa the day of the tsunami. I was actually that story there. I sort of described my experience with that. I was in a briefing room, and the commander comes walking in and says, "We need to go watch CNN." And sure enough, we're literally watching live the tsunami smash into Sendai. And simultaneously, all the tsunami alarms were going off in Okinawa. So I deployed up there the next day, took a team up, and
wow, yeah,
we did some. That was I had never seen destruction at that level before, never seen just so much human suffering, but also seeing how people came together. It was one of the most beautiful things ever. The Japanese people are so respectful and so polite, and their culture of concern and of welfare for the greater good, man. I remember flying over in a helicopter, and there was a gas station, a single gas station, and there was a line of cars 15 miles long, and people are just lined up at this one gas station. Everybody's polite. Everybody has the appropriate distancing from one another, even pre-COVID days.
Yeah.
It was a powerful experience.
And they wear masks, it's hard to wear a mask. I mean, right now I'm wearing a mask, you know, with this COVID-19 thing going, but it just feels weird. You know, it's not part of our culture. Whereas there, you know, they will wear a mask if they are sick so they don't get other people sick.
Yeah, they care about the greater good. It's that team mentality that we have in pararescue and SEAL teams, where we put others before ourselves, and that's something that the Japanese culture embraces for sure.
So, tell me how you got involved in yoga. So it seems to be a very important part of your life right now.
It is, and it has been for probably the last 10 years or so. During some of my darkest periods with PTS, I was offered all the benzodiazepines and antidepressants that docs could find for me. And it didn't resonate with me. I didn't want to have a pill that I considered like a Band-Aid. You know, I was a healer in a sense that I would put my hands on somebody in combat, and like I could go in and fix the problem. I wouldn't just like put a blanket over it. So with this mentality, I was like, well, I think you prescribing me an antidepressant is not getting to the root of the problem. I think me taking this 4 times the recommended dose of benzodiazepines and washing it down with a liter of Jack Daniels every night is not getting to the root of the problem. Sure, it helps me to find some blackness every night and it stops the sensations within, but it's not getting to the root of the problem. So I started to research all these different things, and I had read a book when I was 17. I got it from the library in Australia, and it was about yoga. I don't know why. I was just drawn to it. Maybe with my exposure to other cultures, I saw the way that other people prioritized their what mattered to them in life. And that was always a part of growing up. I tried to learn the different cultures that I was around and things that mattered to them. Somehow ended up with a book on yoga. Skimmed through it and was like, oh wow, that's really cool, that guy's that flexible, right on. And like put the book and took it back to the library and didn't think anything of it for 15 years later. And yoga was something that popped up during my my search for alternative modalities to ease anxiety and symptoms of post-traumatic stress. And then I remember back to that book, and I was like, man, I should look into that, right? Like, I'm this massive dude. I can't touch my opposite shoulder. Like, what do I have to lose, right? Like, I'm so big and I'm so strong. And the reality, I was just, you know, packing weight on and like working through these processes that I thought I was working through by just lifting weights and building muscle. So not the case, right? So I start to practice yoga, and man, I was terrible at it. Like, you know, it's funny now when I teach it, it's like, you're really not terrible. There's no, like, you never reach this end state, but being the type A, you know, operator that I was like, man, I'm going to be the best at this thing. Like, oh, you want to touch my toes? I'm going to touch all the toes. You know,
I remember, you know, we do yoga, you know, we actually have a yoga day. We've kind of turned it into a mobility day, but it hurts.
Yeah.
It hurts.
Yeah.
You know, you're not used to it. It's painful. And you know what? It takes you back to getting comfortable being uncomfortable.
Exactly.
You know, that journey that we all had when we first started, you know, that, you know, I got to get good at this if I want to make this goal. And it kind of takes you back to before everything happened.
For sure.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah. It's, we store a lot of information in our body. You know, the way that we experience the world is, you know, through our senses and through our movement patterns and our body. And it's like, so within our tissue, we store a lot of information, and through repetitive patterns, the way we wear body armor, the way I sit in a helicopter, the way my rifle feels when it recoils in my shoulder, like all of these influences are stored in our, you know, our muscle memory essentially. And part of what yoga as you practice it, it teaches you is to be conscious of these repetitive movements and information that's stored in your body. And as it relates to post-traumatic stress, and as it relates to sort of healing and moving beyond that, when I'm moving through my body and I'm allowing space to come in, it's like I'm allowing movement and freedom of movement within my body so that I can then consciously acknowledge what it is that I'm holding on to and then ultimately release it.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because it is for real. There is an emotion tied to that movement.
Absolutely. Or a memory.
Yeah. Yeah. It's more than just your biceps and shoulder feeling whatever, right? There is a physiological and psychological, element to that. Yeah.
You know, one example that I use, it's a posture series. They're called heart openers. If you don't want to turn off the dudes, you just call it back bending, right? But like, you're exposing this space that you've spent your entire career
protecting,
wearing body armor, right?
Yeah.
Around the shoulders, when I'm shooting, like we're like asking to open this up. But over time, like I round. When I become threatened, I round. I become closed off. I can't take a deep breath when I do that. I stop breathing, and I become I lose the conscious physiological response of actually being alive. So what yoga does is it just gives you these little windows, these little glimpses. Like, right, I'm laying there, I'm uncomfortable, man, this sucks. Okay, cool. And I move on from it. But it's those little glimpses where the body's like, oh, yeah, right on, man. Let's do that again. I can see how I was vulnerable. I can see how I was exposed. I also see how I survived. And I think I like that experience. And you practice every day in some form or fashion, and you grow, and you ultimately can move beyond what it was that was plaguing you, or at the very least you can get like more comfortable with like your flexibility in your body. I mean, it's like there's a win-win either way, right?
Sure, absolutely.
If you want to approach it from the flexibility standpoint, that's like a great start. But ultimately, everybody that I've worked with over time is like, hey, I sleep better at night. I feel better. I have less anxiety. I can take a deeper breath. If I ever have to walk into a Walmart, I can like, all right, now I'm ready. So yoga, yeah, a massive part of my life. And it's moved into more of, my practice has progressed. It's more body control. I love the handstand, the challenging sequencing that for me is harder than any weight I ever lifted, and I feel like I'm stronger now than I've ever been in my life, because I can move my body in ways that I was never able to before.
So you're over 40 now, right? Or right at it. Yeah. Right. So yeah, I got about 11 years on you, but, I learned at 40 that, you really have to start engaging mobility and flexibility a lot more. I mean, yeah. I did a little bit when I was younger, but it was never needed as much as it is needed now.
Oh no, a couple of these bad boys.
Right, you're ready to go.
315 on the bench.
Yeah, exactly. So how are you feeling now compared to, let's say, 10 years ago?
Well, I definitely recognize the sins of my past. They come up every once in a while.
Sure.
The 500-pound deadlifts, they sneak in every once in a while when you sneeze and you're like, oh man, whoa, what was that? But I feel when I look back to, 10, 12 years ago, when I was 240 pounds of just pure hate and anger and muscle, it's like, man, my body hurt. It felt, everything was like acidic inside, and I didn't have this freedom of movement. I couldn't consciously take a breath like I can now. And I think what it comes down to is I can just breathe now. Like my movement practice, my physical practice is sustainable. I can do it every day. I might be a little bit sore from the day before, but I can still move my body in these ways that I want. And I'm always finding new areas to soften and expand. And, I like being a 40-year-old former operator that can do the splits and press into a handstand and like put my leg behind my head. I mean,
that's huge.
It for me, it's like, okay, this is a sustainable practice. Like I have worked through enough of these mobility and these movement patterns that I feel like I have done my part to protect my physical body for as long as I can.
Now you're much leaner now than you were. What's that weight loss difference?
I mean, 50 pounds from like the peak to what I hover at now.
Wow.
I operated at about 220. And I hover right now at about 185, 190.
Nice. So here's something I have discovered, and I learned this after about 40, 45, is that the bigger I am, the more pain I am in.
Yes.
And it's great to be strong. I mean, I grew up powerlifting and playing football, right? I mean, that was, you just wanted to lift and eat and just be big, right? And that was my journeys is how I started, right? And I just love to lift, right? But then after you kind of go through this journey of you got to get good at other things now in the spec ops world, that kind of changes you a little bit, drops you down to a little operating weight. But then you get back into your team and you start lifting again and you get big as hell, right? And so I built myself up to about a 225 zone. And I just remember saying, this isn't sustainable. Like yeah. This hurts. And I made that realization. I've been getting down and down and down, trying to get below 200. I'm right at it right now. I'm trying to get back to my bud's weight. So my bud's weight was 195 30 years ago.
Wow.
So 30 years ago. So I am 5 pounds off my bud's weight. So I'm still moving in that direction. And I'm engaging more flexibility and mobility, largely because of your example.
Thank you.
You know, I won't lie to you because, you know, I see your posts on Instagram. I'm like, man, I got to try to do that.
You know? That's awesome.
You know, and I really want to be more flexible. You know, I want to drop another 10 pounds, right? And be leaner and, you know, really have no pain at 51 years old. And I'm almost there. I mean, it's nice to walk out of the gym after our yoga mobility day, not be exhausted.
Yeah.
You know, not just, you know, and being able to breathe and relax and like, I feel really good. I'm not in any pain. I bend over, touch my toes. Nothing hurts.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
There's a lot of value in being 40 to 50 years old and feeling no pain after an athletic and operational history that spans back till I was 12 years old.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That is a blessing that yoga brings.
For sure. So. Absolutely. That's one of my favorite things is working with operators and former operators who's, you know, they would wake up every morning with back pain or knee pain or joint pain. And you work with them to find some body awareness, body control, take a deep breath and give them a practice that they can then carry on for the rest of their life. That's one of my favorite things is once you learn it, you don't unlearn it, right? You create your own adaptations and you always have this practice to fall back on. And that's, for me, that's my favorite approach to it. Like every morning I wake up, I breathe, I move, I find time to have my devoted practice, but you know, I'll get up throughout the day. I'll press into a handstand. I'll just be upside down and I feel more refreshed. I call it rinsing the brain. I just get upside down. I take a few deep breaths, close my eyes. I'm like, oh, this is amazing. And I always have it available to me.
So you have found a way to engage that parasympathetic nervous system on a multiple daily basis.
Yes.
Multiple times a day. Whereas, you know what?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Whereas where you were in the military, you were probably 100% sympathetically charged.
Constantly. And you needed
year after year after year.
The parasympathetic you only found with like alcohol. That was your down regulation, at least for me. You know, that's what I found. And that's why my life now, I have more sustainable practices that give me a sympathetic response. And I have a sustainable practice that gives me a parasympathetic. I meet them both, you know, and
both are
sustainable.
Yeah, absolutely. Good point. So let's talk a little bit about what you're doing now. Where can people find out about you? I know you have the Beneath the Surface organization, foundation. Let's talk about that a little bit. And what are you doing now, Matt?
Beneath the Surface Foundation is a nonprofit organization that teaches special operations and combat veterans yoga and ocean therapy. And what it is a complete basically a yoga teacher training. We have a series of interactive video instruction. It's our curriculum that is designed to take a former operator with zero yoga experience and give them a sustainable practice that they can then have for the rest of their life. And we combine that with ocean therapy, which is a really sexy way of saying surfing, kiteboarding, freediving, all these things. We touched on it earlier, it's a sympathetic response, right? Rather than going out and buying a brand new Ducati and driving at 140 miles an hour, we give them a sustainable practice. Hey, we're going to teach you how to kiteboard. We're going to teach you how to surf. We're going to give you this nature-based connection. And we're also going to teach you down-regulation, parasympathetic response with yoga. So we tailor these two modalities and we package them in a way that allows combat and special operations veterans to move beyond post-traumatic stress. It gives them sustainable practices that they then can carry out for the rest of their life. For this year, for 2020, we're actually running a clinical study to prove the efficacy of our delivery. And nice. Yeah, so we're taking 50 applicants. It's actually about to kick off here in the next few weeks. And we package them with a 6-week preparatory phase where we take them from the ground up in the privacy of their own home, living room, team room, wherever they want to practice. And we guide them through the whole thing, breathing, meditation, yoga, sequencing, movement. At the end of that 6 weeks, we're going to take 15, all expenses paid, to the Dominican Republic pending the COVID crisis ends. This is actually scheduled for October. If it doesn't, we'll obviously reassess. But the intent is to take 15 of them to the Dominican Republic where we all come together and we practice twice daily yoga, and they also take surf and kiteboarding lessons.
Awesome.
So it's great, right? So we're giving them these tools that they can then carry on for the rest of their life. One of my favorite things is teaching a 42-year-old former SEAL some yoga and then teaching him how to kiteboard, right? So now he's a big-time kiter in San Diego, and like that's his focus. He wakes up in the morning, he moves his body, he breathes, he stretches, he does his movement sequence, and then he puts a kite in the sky and goes out and rides. And he comes back and he's reborn every day, and he has that to fall back on. It's a similar model to what I focused on when I left active duty. I moved to Hawaii and I returned to my roots as a windsurfer, as a waterman, a kiteboarder, a surfer, and just found, I used the analogy of when in the movie The Shawshank Redemption, when Andy Dufresne was in his prison, and every day he would like scrape away at the wall of his prison. And he'd walk out in the yard and he'd shake his pant leg out, and all the walls of his prison would land in the yard. For me, it was the yoga was chipping away at my internal armor, my prison. And then I'd go out into the ocean and I'd release it. And that was when I would find some clarity, some rebirth, and I would go back in and start the practice again the next day. So it was really important for me to carry on that others may live. Our motto is a PJ. Only now living is more than just a pulse and vital signs. It's restoring vitality and giving these men and women who are standing in the darkness an outlet from which to grow beyond PTS.
Well, I love the name of Beneath the Surface Foundation, because it's obviously playing on both sides.
Of course.
Under the ocean and beneath the surface.
Beneath yourself, yes.
I like it. I love that. Thank you. Yeah, that's a really cool program. Yeah, that movie is a classic. You know, one of my favorite scenes is not much after that, when he's crawling through the crap and he finally breaks through the tunnel and he's looking up and the sky is raining on him and he just takes this huge inhale, right? He's just like, he just breathes. And that's a great little scene there that...
Well, what would you do after crawling through that tunnel?
Oh, my God. Yeah, it was pretty impressive. Yeah. So what's next? What's next for you as far as,
I think
through your fifth decade in the next decade?
I think, once we've identified what we're supposed to be doing in these phases of our life, and they change, you know, obviously for a good, 20-year period of my life, my focus was on becoming a PJ and having a career in the military. And now my focus is on giving back. It's on giving back to those who have walked a similar path, and also preparing those who are about to walk a similar path. It's, you know, I work a lot with young guys who want to join the military and join these special operations teams. And it's about building up that mental resilience before they even set foot into training and giving them a practice that they can then work with. So it's that's the focus, that's the mission. It's taking the lessons that I've learned and the experiences that I've had and not having them be for nothing. And it's packaging it in a way that resonates with the men and women who are in these circles, you know, the special operations community, the military community. And that's what motivates me every day. It's what I think about when I go to bed. It's what I think about when I wake up, you know, how can I serve others today? And that's the focus for the foreseeable future. I don't see that changing anytime soon.
That is awesome. Now, PJ is an awesome medic also, right? Yes. Obviously you are a combat medic. Do you get to still use any of those skills today that you've learned in your military?
Every once in a while, I'll teach a class on how to start an IV in someone's finger, something sexy like that. But that market of combat medicine and instruction is pretty saturated, and it's also something that I think when I left, I was credited with all the saves that I needed for a lifetime. And I'd rather choose to save lives in other ways now, rather than applying the tourniquets and the chest tubes and all the medical interventions. I shift my focus to saving lives in other ways now.
So that's awesome.
Yeah.
Nice. So any last words for the audience, whether you're young or old, because I will tell you this, you have not only inspired young kids to want to be PJs or special operators as well, but you've inspired me to be more flexible, more internally focused, and like I said, your Instagram is really good. Special operator, you guys got to follow it, and you'll learn something every day, from it. So I appreciate it. So any last words for young and old?
I think, as far as warrior cultures, if you go back and you go through history and you study warrior cultures, societies who we look back, we're like, wow, that was a culture of warriors. They prioritized their mental, their emotional well-being. They prioritized their whole person concept, and not just on becoming, the tip of the spear and the biggest badass on the block. I think we can learn a lot from these cultures of the past where they focused on being a good human first. They focused on prioritizing their friendships, speaking authentically, being a good family person, being a good human being in general. The whole warrior, it's better to be a warrior in the garden than a gardener in the fight. And I think if we develop more of our whole person skills and not just focusing on like, hey, I got to make it through the selection course, but because you're also living your life at that same time too. So if you're a young person, I encourage you to really embrace the wisdom of guys who are, our age and older, who look back and like, man, I was still living my life when I was 19 and going through selection. Like, how could I have done that better? And how could I have made the rest of my life easier? And for the older guys, it's like, yeah, we're still alive. We're still kicking. We're still in the fight. Let's live the rest of our days as comfortable and as at peace as we have. We've all suffered. We've all sacrificed. And how can we really enjoy, this next phase of our life? And, it's available. There's something out there. And, I choose to focus and teach, only a very few specific modalities, but those ones I teach them very passionately and I teach them very authentically. And, never stop learning, never stop testing yourself. So, yeah.
Yeah. I love it. Well, Matt, thank you so much for, doing this interview with me, taking your time to do that. It means a lot. I appreciate it. It's going to help somebody else as well. So hopefully it helps you as well with your, things that you're doing. And once again, when something helps you, you're going to be able to help more people. So
awesome. Steve. Well, thanks for having me on. It was great to chat with you. And I really appreciate you having me on.
Thank you very much. Until next time, my friend.